This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. Have you ever played Guitar Hero, the music video game jamming on a plastic Stratocaster in your living room? Or maybe you're not the type to rock out. You prefer sitting down with a nice book, maybe an e-book perhaps, on your Kindle. Well, either way, you can thank the MIT lab, the media lab there at MIT, because of those popular pastimes. They're spun off from ideas developed at the lab, like the e-ink that puts the words on your Kindle screen, or a joystick-controlled computer program to improvise music on the fly, which later developed into games like Guitar Hero and Rock Band. The lab was born 25 years ago in those primordial days of 1985, when high-tech meant an Apple II or an 8-bit Commodore 128. This hour, we're celebrating the Media Lab's birthday, talking with one of its founders, taking a look at some of the projects being developed there today, projects that may be part of your home tomorrow. So what sort of technology are we going to see over the next 25 years? And what would you like to see? Share your ideas with us. Give us a call, 1-800-989-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. Maybe we'll run some of those ideas past our folks, the guests who are coming on from the Media Lab at MIT. And let me introduce our Media Lab first guest, Nicholas Negroponte. He is founder and chairman of One Laptop Per Child. He is also co-founder and the former director of the MIT Media Lab in Cambridge. And he joins us from a studio on the campus today. Welcome back.
Hi, Ira. Glad to be here.
Nice to have you back. Let's talk about the beginnings. Why did the lab start up? What was the vision there?
Well, the lab started at a very specific time. Personal computers were just being born. The telephone company was deregulated, and people figured out that the digital world was for real. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to create a place where the inventors of new media and the creative users were in the same place, sometimes even in the same head.
Huh. And has that focus changed? Did you have to – I can't say tweet it, you know – tweet anymore because it means something else.
Yeah.
Did you have to change it a little bit as you went through the years?
Well, as time developed, it became a place for just iconoclastic thinking in general. If you want to do something that was impossible in your field, you came to the Media Lab. The first 10 to 15 years were in relative lockstep obedience with the title. After that, it started to branch out and become more the place to do something that was counterintuitive.
Your lab was born, if I recall, just about the same time that Bell Labs closed up shop. And that was, you know, famous for other great inventions like the transistor. Was there a similarity? Was there a coincidence? Do you see yourself as sort of having the same mindset of those creative folks over there?
Well, there was certainly no cause and effect. What there was a like-mindedness in not trying to direct the research, that what you do is you hire and attract really great people. And after that, they are not on their own. That isn't so much the point. The point is that the work they do is really from the heart and is from their passion, not some agenda that the lab has.
So nothing is too crazy. Ruled out.
Nothing is too crazy.
Give us an idea of some crazy things that you're thinking about.
Oh, you know, you mentioned in your introduction e-ink, electronic ink for your Kindle. One person suggested e-ink tattoos. So when you do a tattoo, forbid, that it's actually a computer display. Other people have suggested and actually succeeded in making audio be a spotlight, which the physicists said wasn't possible. So you could point something and project audio at a very specific point in space and a distance. Things like that, from the technical to sort of the, let me say, the creative application.
Are there some things that you just could not get to work that you tried over the years to do, some ideas?
Well, one of the things we've always aspired to do is build machines that could read closed books. Still haven't been able to do that. I'd like to throw a book into something like a microwave oven and have the computer read it all rather than flipping pages. We haven't managed to do teleportation, where maybe a similar microwave oven, you know, deconstructs and reconstructs. It's things like that people like to try and do, but that's so impossible for the time being that we focus on sort of slightly less impossible problems.
Has your funding sources, have they changed over the years?
Well, we adopted back 25 years ago a funding model where we went to industry rather than government, but we did it on a, let me call it a club basis, where you joined this club and you shared intellectual property and money flowed. We grew 10% per year, 50% per year for the next 15 years. That has changed because industry's become a bit more conservative, but it hasn't dried up at all. It's still something companies love because otherwise they're just listening to themselves and their consultants.
Mm-hmm. You're founder of the One Laptop Per Child program. Can you give us an update on that? How well is that going?
It's doing fantastically. There are 2 million of them in the field in 40 countries, 25 languages. It's more about the countries. It's countries like Afghanistan, Rwanda. We're in Gaza. Uruguay is one country that's done every single child in the country. And if you just take the concept, one laptop per child, and put that string into Google and have Google alerts, you'll get 30 or 40 a night, which is wonderful. It doesn't necessarily mean us. It's just as a concept, it's now contagious.
If you were to start that over today, would it still be a laptop or might it be a tablet?
Oh, it would certainly be a tablet. It would be a tablet for a variety of reasons, cost, book likeness, making it something that could be manufactured very inexpensively. So, yes, it would be a tablet, but the laptop launch was just fine.
How do you think the iPad is doing, and how would you have done it differently, or would you do it differently if it came out of your lab?
Oh, I think the iPad is superb. I bought 5 of them, and I use it all the time. It is for the market that it's serving. It's a little too heavy, it's a little too this, a little too that, but it's a splendid thing to have happened. And I find that it is just sort of the proof of a new kind of computing, one that isn't like mobile computing in your pocket, and it isn't desktop computing or laptop computing, which is more nomadic and you sit down and use it explicitly. It's a very nice in-between space that you find as you use it has properties you just would never expect that really change how we use the digital world or participate in the digital world.
How do you come up with a new idea? Is it one person's? Do you sit around and schmooze about what might be possible? Is there a flash of genius at some point?
It's very rarely one person. It's usually multiple people. It doesn't have to be a session where you sit down and say, let's have an idea. And it's often through misunderstanding. It's through people looking at something from different perspectives. The part of the Media Lab that I'm the most proud of is the interdisciplinary nature. We are an academic department in the sense that we could admit students, hire faculty, and give tenure, but nobody's from the same discipline. So when a problem is raised or a solution is discovered, people look at them from different points of view, and that's what makes for the steady stream, in fact, a disproportionately high stream, if you compare it to any other lab, of just new and wild ideas. And we talk very early, so sometimes our ideas are taken, integrated into something else, and they don't really come out distinct at the end or recognizable, this is the piece the Media Lab did, but the influence is always there. Lots of companies come back to me and say, oh, you don't realize back 20 years ago we made this, this, and this decision based on what we saw. And that's the part that you don't get to see except maybe 10 years later when somebody tells you.
Yeah. Talking with Nicholas Negroponte, who is founder and chairman of the One Laptop Per Child, and he's co-founder and former director of the MIT Media Lab in Cambridge. I'd like to bring on another guest now. He's working to reinvent the way we see the world by reinventing the camera. Ramesh Raskar is leader of the Camera Culture Group at the MIT Media Lab. He joins us there. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
You've been quoted as saying, at first there will be one device for everything, and later it will fragment all over your body.
Certainly.
Tell me how that would work.
The idea that we would carry one single device in our pocket to do all the work for us, sensing, you know, all different sensors, mm-hmm. all different signals. It's just not going to scale. And we can easily imagine devices that are different parts of our body, wearable computing, a concept very much invented at the Media Lab. And we're going to see that more and more as time goes on.
Mm-hmm. So right now we have like one device, like a smartphone, and we want it to do everything for us. And you're saying that's going to be split up into lots of little devices that we may carry, maybe embedded. Who knows where these things will be?
Certainly.
Is that basically what you're saying?
Yes. I mean, the fact that your smartphone has a speaker and a microphone and other types of sensors embedded in one single device seems somewhat odd because your own body doesn't have all the senses concentrated in one place. Mm-hmm. So if you want to hear something or if you want to smell, they should be in appropriate places. So we are not, falling over and tripping over all the wires that we'll be creating, or even the wireless networks we'll have to maintain between these components.
You've talked about having cameras on your fingertips. Why would we want that?
As a child, you probably have an experience of sticking your hand in a cookie jar, right. And you're basically using your fingers as your senses to figure out what's going on inside. If it's a jar. So imagine if you just put tiny cameras in each of your fingers, and they would transmit back this nice panorama of what's going on inside. And you can imagine more serious applications. Maybe doctors have them on their fingertips. So during surgery, they have a view. Their senses for touch and vision is embedded in one and the same thing. For industrial applications and so on. So having kind of an extension of our vision across our body. I think, an exciting
It's a nice play on words. You have a camera at your fingertips, literally. We're going to take a break, come back and talk more with Ramesh Raskar and Nicholas Negroponte in the 25th anniversary of the Media Lab at MIT. Stay with us. Our number 1-800-998-2255. You can tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. We'll be right back. You're listening to Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about the 25th anniversary of the MIT Media Lab in Cambridge with Ramesh Raskar and Nicholas Negroponte. Our number 1-800-998-2255. Ramesh, tell us about this project where you can get your eyes checked by your cell phone. Is it going to put the optometrist out of business, or how do you envision this? I've seen this on your website.
We're building a thermometer for your eye. And if you can measure your eyesight, your nearsightedness, farsightedness, and astigmatism using a portable device, that would be something you would use. It's going to measure. It's not going to prescribe. So it's not a replacement for an optometrist or an ophthalmologist. And the idea there really is to realize that your cell phone is now actually a high-end scientific instrument because the resolution of your screens has improved to an extent where every pixel is 28 micrometers, half the width of a human hair. And at that resolution, you can start doing some amazing things, such as building devices for medical purposes.
Mm-hmm. So this would be a device that you attach to your cell phone. You look into it. It measures your eye and says, oops, you should go see your optometrist or your ophthalmologist, somebody like
yes,
that.
Yes, it's a clip-on that goes on top of your cell phone. And you would look through it, align some patterns interactively using the keyboard of the cell phone. And when the patterns are aligned, you hit calculate, and then the software that's loaded in the phone would do the calculations for you.
It sounds like it's something would be perfect for use in developing countries where you may not have doctors everywhere.
Yes, very much. And as we are talking about the $100 laptop, the idea that we have to think ground up about some of the solutions. Clearly, in developed countries, there are already great solutions for providing eye care. But in developing countries, the access to eye care is a huge challenge. 500 million people worldwide have uncorrected error that leads to illiteracy and poverty.
Mm-hmm. You're the leader of something called the Camera Culture Group, and you believe that cameras are going to be the focus, of our future. Is that right? Do you think cameras will be used everywhere?
Certainly. I mean, the proliferation of cell phones has changed the game of how many cameras are out there. More than 1 billion cameras are sold per year. But the sad part of that is almost all of those cameras are trying to mimic the human eye. And even if you just look across the animal kingdom, there is a whole variety and diffusion of different kinds of imaging modalities. And on top of that, we have computation. So we have some really exciting opportunities to build types of cameras that go well beyond human visual experience that we are familiar with.
Do you have any fears about privacy with all these cameras being everywhere?
I think we have to. Those are definitely concerns: privacy and safety and misuse of visual information. But I'm a firm believer that as long as we have the right science and the right engineering behind it, and make sure it's developed in an atmosphere where there's a lot of criticism. And Media Lab, again, is a great place where we have not just scientists, but people who think about the social aspect, the policy aspect, and so on.
Nicholas, do you ever worry about the law of unintended consequences in work that you do?
Well, I don't know if worry is the right word. You have to be aware of it. And I'm very fond of saying that what the Media Lab does is invent solutions and other people find the problems. And in that context, you have a steady stream of ideas, and I can take almost any idea and twist it into something negative. So you have to count on the culture doing exactly what Ramesh just said, and the checks and balances in the culture is what's going to do it. It's not the technologists putting some kind of speed brake on their work.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phone. Sir Rich in Philadelphia. Hi, Rich.
Hey, thank you.
Hi there. Go ahead.
Love your show. Always have, like, decades, it seems.
Thank you.
The thing that I noticed in the media recently was something that came to light in a study that was on a U.S. campus, and I wish I could recall which campus, but it was kind of ghosty in its description, where people were busy thumbing and interacting with one another through devices, and literally there was not chatter on the commons. People were quiet and interacting with one another through a digital device.
So they're all sitting there, hundreds of them, and no one's saying a word to each other, at least not vocally.
Yeah.
Well, there are two aspects of that. One is to be in multiple places at the same time, something that didn't really cross my mind when I was that age. I was in one place at one time, and people now, it's almost marginally different to be in the real space versus some other space with somebody. And then the second piece of it, which I think is also important to recognize, is that it is an icebreaker for people. People actually will text other people saying things they might not say face-to-face, which for dating, for meeting, for it actually is an asset, not a liability. So, yeah, you probably can look at it and say, well, there are not enough people smelling the flowers on the grass, but there's probably a lot more interaction, a lot more connectivity, a lot more hanging out, if you will. Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks for calling, Rich.
You're welcome. I think the difference of hanging out is something that he's gotten to, which I guess makes me feel uncomfortable. Thanks.
All right. 1-800-998-8255. Ramesh, Roscoe, I want to thank you for taking time to be with us today, and good luck in your work.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Let me see if I can go to the phones and get another question in or two, because there are lots of people. Let me go. No, there was a tweet that came in that kind of reflects, I guess, what people are thinking about. Smiling Because says, can people be invisible yet? You know, we keep hearing about these cloaking devices and things like that. What are your thoughts, Nicholas, on that?
Well, the closest I've heard of it is where you have a wearable computer that happens to be displaying, let's say, on your back what is in front of you. So when somebody's looking at you from the rear, you are the scene. To actually become invisible otherwise is one of those problems that maybe the next generation will figure out.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Michael in Fayette, Alabama. Hi, Michael.
Good afternoon. I heard which one of those guests is with Laptops Without Borders, or One Laptop Per Child.
That's
organization.
Nicholas is here.
Yeah,
oh,
that's me.
I have nothing but really high praise for your organization. As a Christian, I sure wish that you all could do some projects with missionary child sponsorship charitable agency, faith-based agencies in the future. Here's my question. As both a cartoonist hoping to, Disney-style cartoonist, hoping to work in the animation or toy manufacturing industry someday, but also in auto design, and as a person with a mild disability, I'm a big collector of RoboSapien brands from Wowie Toys and from other companies, and we've all seen those commercials for the Honda Asimo robot to help people in real need. What do you see as the future of both robots for the humanoid robots for really disabled people, seriously disabled people, and cartoony robots and so forth for the toy industry? I would like to not only help design them someday and own that do both and to own one, but I would like to see them priced low enough so that families in the third world and low-income families in this country can afford them. Would you comment on that? And I'll take my answer.
Thank you.
Thanks big time. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too. Nicholas. Well,
sure. Very quickly. The use of robotics to eliminate disability, period, is a wonderful aspiration, and there are several people at the Media Lab doing that. There's another aspect which our caller didn't mention, and that is you can use robotics for perfectly healthy people to make them do things they couldn't do otherwise, like carry a 1,000-pound knapsack on their back or jump over a car or do things like that.
Fighting aliens in space.
Fighting aliens.
Right.
The toy market is real, and it's going to go down. The prices will go down. But in the developing world, it's really, really important, because to be disabled in the developing world is to be marginalized in a way that we don't completely understand, in the sense that kids are just written off. And that's really tragic. So we have to get these prosthetic devices down to such a low cost that they can be used widely in the very poorest and most remote parts of the world.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. You can tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. I want to bring on another guest to give us a taste of another kind of research going on at the lab, and that is technology that studies how we humans move, how we interact with each other, technology that can listen to us, figure out if we're outgoing, shy, or depressed, or maybe even rude. Alex Sandy Pentland is director of the Human Dynamics Lab at MIT Media Lab. He joins us there. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Pentland.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So you're studying, tell us about these projects that track people with their cell phones. What information do you want to get from the phones? What do you want to do with it?
Well, the question we asked really is, if you look at psychology and sociology and things like that, it's mostly things they do in the lab with questionnaires. And we wanted to ask the question, how do people really act out in the real world? And we didn't want to focus so much on all the details of mind games and word games and stuff, because we think that a lot of human nature is something that we inherited from hundreds of millions of years of evolution. So we started by building little sensor things, like Ramesh was talking about, to track where people went and how they nodded with each other or shook hands or responded to one another. And then we noticed that, of course, cell phones have accelerometers. They know where they are. They have microphones. So we began using them to watch the motions of up to hundreds and sometimes even thousands of people, all of which is done under human subjects approval. So don't get at me about that, but privacy is critical. And the thing that we find is really interesting is that these patterns that we have with each other are very stereotyped across different cultures, and they're very predictive of outcome. So some of the things that always amuse people is we've been able to listen to people negotiating salaries and predict the salary to within about $1,000 without listening to the words. It's just the sort of dominance patterns between people.
You mean from their interaction, just the interaction? Didn't matter what they say, but how they say it, it was more important.
That's right, yeah. Or, for instance, you mentioned depression. Depression's perhaps the major source of disability in the world.
Right.
It's massively underdiagnosed. But it turns out that if you listen to how people interact with each other, you can screen for depression quite effectively. And some of my students have gone off and actually started a little company to do that.
Mm-hmm. What is this device I've heard about called the jerkometer?
The jerkometer, yes. Well, so everybody knows that husbands tend not to listen to their wives. And so that inspired us to put something into a cell phone that when you got done speaking with your wife, it would give you a jerk rating to see just how much of a jerk you were in terms of not listening and not responding to her. A very popular device.
And the cell phone could tell that. I mean,
it's
not just playing back what you said, but it has listened in on your conversation, maybe
your
body language.
Measures your attention, your excitement, from your body language, from the pattern of how you speak, from who interrupts who, things like that. And it gives you a sense of, were you paying attention to her? Were you excited when you were supposed to be excited?
Well, if you can tell all that from the cell phone, could the cell phone help you be better then?
Absolutely.
In what way could you do that?
Well, the jerkometer is a really sort of simple example where, you know, when you have some interaction, it gives you a little grade at the end that says, you should have done a little better with that one. Mm-hmm. But the other sort of thing that we've been able to do is looking at distance teams where you have people working in different parts of a city or different countries and giving feedback about the body language and attention of the other people. And in lab experiments, we find that you can make distance teams actually work as well as face-to-face teams if you give them feedback about this social signaling that they're doing. Because that's really the key thing is people can read each other. It's like a sort of social sense. So they're reading people's social signals. And what we've been able to do is put that in a little bit of software and read the interaction.
Huh. Talking about the 25th anniversary of the MIT Media Lab on Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow talking with Sandy Pentland and Nicholas Negroponte. Nicholas, do you have goals, any bigger goals for the lab? Or basically, do you take one small step at a time for the next 25 years?
Oh, we don't take any small steps, Ira. I've been on leave to do one laptop per child for 4 years, so I'm not as good a judge about what's happening now, but I do know that the people who are attracted to the Media Lab are attracted by it being a place to make big changes, not little ones. And so incrementalism is the enemy of creativity, and if there's any incrementalism at the Media Lab, it's a mistake. I haven't spotted it, and it shouldn't be. It should be really a place to be risk-free in the sense that you feel confident enough that you can take these wild plunges. And you know what? If it doesn't work, you've learned an awful lot, and the students learn a lot.
Mm-hmm. And people are willing to give you the latitude to do that, the funding, the space, things like that.
Yes, because there's very few other places to do that. And so it's got to be someplace. And one of the reasons a university makes sense is that the product, if you will, of the university is very much students. And the students who work on these projects, they in fact learn more about the projects and from the projects that fail than the ones that succeed. So you're still doing your mission, and you're also being a place to take this kind of risk and have these kind of ideas.
Sandy Pentland, do you have a big idea you're working on that you'd like to share with us?
Well, yeah. The interesting thing about this being able to read people and use the cell phones, the cameras, things that are all in our environment, is we can now get a better sense of the networks in our society. So not just how many people go by this corner, but where do they start and where do they end? You can begin to sort of notice patterns, like when people get sick, you can see that they begin to behave differently. So it's possible to think about making a society that has really smart networks. A lot of our society was designed in the late 1800s. You can imagine it really being something that is alive and very sensitive to the people and very reactive and supportive. And I think that's the only way we're going to make our culture green, only way we're going to stop diseases like SARS, and the way we're going to make sure that everybody has access to all the sort of resources of society.
Well, wish you good luck to both of you, and happy anniversary. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Nicholas Negroponte, founder and chairman of the One Laptop Per Child. He's also co-founder, former director of the MIT Media Lab in Cambridge. Alex Sandy Pentland is director of the Human Dynamics Lab at the MIT Lab there also. We're going to take a break and come back and talk about Google's and that car that may be running itself. We'll see. We'll talk about cars of the past that tried to do that too. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR.